Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Neanderthal. This talk is delivered by Professor Ivan Kalous.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome to the last of this year's seminars in the series Work in Progress in the Social Studies, better known as WIPS. We began this year's seminars with Dr. Stephen Lyon, anthropologist at the University of Durham. We have had a total of 8 seminars, including tonight, which included, among others, Professor Peter Mayo from our own Faculty of Education, Dr. Ruth Lyon, ethnomusicologist at Cambridge University, and Professor David Napier, medical anthropologist at University College London. We are very happy to end the series with Professor Ivan Kalous. Professor Ivan Kalous is head of the Department of English at the University of Malta, where he teaches contemporary narrative and literary theory. He has published in many academic journals and is co-editor of the critical post-humanism series published by Rodopi. He has also co-edited 3 books, Sai Borges, Memories of Post-Humanism in the work of Jorge Luis Borges. Secondly, Discipline and Practice, The Irresistibility of Theory, both published by Bucknell University. And thirdly, Post-Theory Culture Criticism, published by Rodopi. Ivan tells me he wants to soon present a revised version of tonight's paper at a conference. Is it at the University of Wales? At the University of Cardiff. So he very much looks forward to your feedback. That indeed is the whole purpose of all of these seminars, to achieve friendly feedback in hopefully an informal and inviting atmosphere. And please, since this is our last meeting together, let me remind you that if you have an interesting research proposal, a paper you wish to give in next year's series, based upon research you are now doing, please send me an email. That's paul.clough, C-L-O-U-G-H, at um.edu.mt. I think you'll find that email address in the university announcements whenever our seminars are listed. So we look forward to hearing from you, and if you want to give a paper based on your own research, please get in touch with me. Well, that means I'm now very happy to hand over to Professor Kalous, whose paper has the enthralling title Neanderthal.
Thanks very much, Dr. Clough. And thanks for the opportunity of presenting what is very much, I must warn you, work in progress, so I hope you can bear with that. The title of my talk is Neanderthal. The subtitle is Posthumanism and History, and I'm trying to explore the implicit paradox in that phrase. I can't resist an epigraph, and I have 4. The first one is from Jacques Derrida's The Animal That Therefore I Am. It reads, "Since so long ago, can we say that the animal has been looking at us?" The second epigraph from the same book is, "In the beginning, I would like to trust myself to words that, were it possible, would be naked." The third epigraph is from Maurice Blanchot's Awaiting Oblivion. It's the first sentence of that book. And it reads, "Here and on the sentence that he was..." that I'll repeat that. "Here and on the sentence that was perhaps also meant for him, he was obliged to stop." The fourth epigraph, well, is the last phrase, the last words of Maurice Blanchot's The Last Man, and it simply reads, "Later he ellipses, later he dot dot dot." We are already post-apocalyptic and have been for many millennia. Possibly the most significant event in the history of the human race, the extinction of a species of human, happened roughly 30,000 years ago. It pretty much trumps all current talk, one would have thought, of speciesism, as well as all the pieties about the lesser marks of difference that turn on class, race, gender, or any other semiotic of variegated humanity. Yet this most complete of holocausts, which wiped away arguably the most fundamental disparity ever to mark humanity, and in the wake of which any discourse on universality becomes possible, and any identification of difference invited to keep proportion and perspective, well, it's relatively absent from the cultural imaginary. That's curious, for the basic facts of the story, at least as they are usually told, are simple and gripping enough. In the Pleistocene period, when humanity was supposedly at its wildest, most savage and most animal, even when being already recognizably human, or at any rate hominid, Neanderthal humanity had arguably the first and rawest post-human experience of all, apocalypse and complete extinction. Human enough and all too human already, on the cusp of knowledge and of technique, but not quite in apprehension of them, Neanderthal humanity fails the most animal of tests, the survival of the fittest. Unfit for humanity, it yields the planet to Homo sapiens, to man, as we once collectively called ourselves, to an inevitable dynamic within sapientia, and hence to knowledge and wisdom, and to the process that ushers techne from animality, zoon technikon from zoe, culture from absolute disaster. After Neanderthal, then Homo sapiens. After the human, more humanity, and a claiming of wisdom. In truth and in wisdom, we have barely any facts at all, of course. Very little can be said about this event on which everything that has happened since hangs. How, indeed, is one to speak of this most momentous event in prehistory, after which a good deal of the rest is not even history yet? Language and representation are disarmed here. In bearing reference to Neanderthal humanity, whose coming and passing underwrites everything both then and thereafter, all the means and modes of all disciplines of human inquiry are discountenanced. There is no precise countenance we can put on Neanderthal, no face or figure that we can put on this human animal, without finding ourselves already in a crypto-prosopopeic revivification that finds itself speculation-rich and resolution poor. This paper, acutely aware that it can add nothing much of any substance to that effort, will accordingly not be attempting any contribution to the understanding of Neanderthal biology or society, or to the circumstances which led to their evolving to and away from survival. I have, in any case, no paleoanthropological training, so it is just as well that I should say nothing at all about a story on which the only semi-definitive information available is that it happened. Instead, I shall be speaking a little bit about two issues above all that I find myself drawn to when thinking about Neanderthal. The first has to do with this very discomposure within the disciplines in regards to Neanderthal that I have just alluded to. More specifically, I am interested in how the representation of Neanderthal in literature engages the figuration of that which is figureless, the human animal without language, society, culture, or history, as we have come to know these, and as such, and thus circumstanced, the human animal in as absolute a space of non-relation as has configured itself in finite space and time, just to be hyperbolical. By extension, what are the necessary contortions of language and reference in regard to pre-linguistic and prehistoric consciousness? What kind of counterintuitive aesthetics emerges there, and what is it in the scene of human inquiry into the scarcely human that might be singularly important? The second point emerges then from this, and it is marked by an irony. As human inquiry moves ever more unstoppably to considerations of post-humanism, of the various interlinked and disparate stories of code and genetic information, and prostheses, and digitality, and final apocalypse that we appear compelled towards, Neanderthal, the human animal who is in one sense pre-human, offers us as complete and resolved a story of how we became post-human, and with as much loading on the present as any of the very many futurity-rich others we foretell. My second interest, then, is in how Neanderthal, prehistoric, and in one sense pre-human, and yet in another sense, all too human, paradoxically brought us forth the experience of the post-human to the human species whose time it made easier through its own extinction. So that, as you will have guessed by now, Neanderthal becomes interesting in this kind of inquiry, not in and for itself, but as a support for a thought experiment, a figure, or an algorithm even, in which what is at stake is not the conferring of greater definition and resolution on its time and practices, but the understanding of such ground as can be staked out for the exploration of world-building and presumably self-apprehending experience without any very apparent or structured investment in language, culture, or technique. To such a mode of inquiry, Neanderthal, Zoon if not Zoon technikon, Homo not quite sapiens, and in various degrees prehistoric, pre-cultural, pre-linguistic, pre-temporal, and pre-societal, Neanderthal names the possibility of the human and a parallel potentiality for it in the same moment that it names finite humanity. It is the name of an almost unthinkable and yet achieved, and hence just about historicizable, human experience that is tantalizingly available to excavation and reconstruction, even while, as we shall see, it defeats reimagining. And while we explore the nature of that inevitably failed reimagining, it is as well to remember that it is because of Neanderthal's passing that we are human in the way we are, and always already post-human. For theorists of narrative who still speculate on storyless stories, on novels without characters, on narratorial unreliability, on point of view and voice, this, interestingly, may be the ultimate experiment. Even simply a story and development, it bears analysis. Certainly, the drama couldn't be more involving or of greater consequence. We know, or dimly know, what happened. Quite simply, the other died. How and why it did, while a great mystery, is for the purposes of this paper not as important as the fact of the death. The other humans, the other to the human, the other mode of being human and animal, died out. Somewhere within the most inaccessible recesses of our conscious collective memory must be lodged the trauma of that witnessed and survived experience. Yet it has to be said that in all this, the solidity of specification, to cite one of Henry James's imperatives for storytelling, is pretty poor. The characterization, particularly, is lamentable, inevitably skeletal. We never see the main players. Place, too, is mysterious, though for those interested in the eco-critical dimensions of all this, the landscapes are as pristine as they will ever get. More importantly still, and to get to what is problematic in all this by recalling Foucault, what does it matter who is speaking? But it does, of course, in the story above all. If, together with agencies dimly glimpsed, we are co-authors of the story of extinction, perhaps extermination, where we are also characters, then narratorial reliability, it has to be said, is a little suspect, for there may be some bias in their point of view. You know what I mean. Here is a story of a contest for the world entire and for time itself, a drama where the audience are the villains of the piece who tell the tale, because their prize was the history they would go on eventually to write and more fundamentally live, and who seem singularly and pointedly free of the guilt of the victor survivor. Except for specialists, no one in fact remembers or commemorates Neanderthal anymore, or hardly. They are too busy living the survival. And yet how does one hide an extinct species of human, even if it is prehistoric, rendering it hardly present to cultural memory? Where did we hide this body in our libraries? How do archives and museums, literature and cinema, painting and the other arts, abet or resist cultural amnesia and disregard? Consider the contrast with the dinosaurs, who are much more present to the popular imagination than Neanderthal. They have had their Jurassic Park. And as every parent knows, dinosaurs are very good with children. Neanderthal humanity, by contrast, is not so easily brought into the living room or to a multiplex near you. It is not quite so amenable to Hollywood representation, or indeed to any representation at all. Inevitably, in telling the story, one anthropomorphizes. How else is it to be told? But anthropomorphic Neanderthal is not human, not like us, not quite. So that the phenomenology of that state, with such thoughts and emotions and crises as can be evoked, frustrates our language and must depend on suggestion, not on any technique of mimesis, which could not possibly configure verisimilitude in this regard. Indeed, it is striking how dissatisfying the attempts to meet the challenge have tended to be. Perhaps we should remember here that in film, for instance, the representation even of humanity later to Neanderthal often comes across as ridiculous. The dates are all wrong here, but Raquel Welch in 1 Million Years BC, for instance, a 1966 film, would doubtless have been pleasing to the prehistoric male gaze, but the final effect of the movie is, shall we say, underwhelming. More intriguing are movies which stage the gaze of one human species on another, but even here the outcome is often disappointing. It is quite striking how in films of this kind, the key moment is when one example of Neanderthal sees one example of Homo sapiens. The tracing of the look is always quite dramatic. And the clan of the cavier, of the cave bear, the sensitivity of in the film The Clan of the Cave Bear, the sensitivity of Jean Noël's book of the same name, from which the movie is adapted, is undermined by a treatment that seems minded to suggest, for instance, through the casting of Daryl Hannah, that even in Cro-Magnon times, gentlemen may have preferred blondes. Other movies on a related theme, 10,000 BC, or Encino Man, for instance, similarly fail to respond to the otherwise intrinsically sublime nature of their content, or to engage on another than superficial level with what they nevertheless intuit to be two shaping aspects to the dramatic and conceptual core to their story. The first turns on the possibility, extent, nature, and prolongation of the gaze and of intercourse, in all senses of this latter term, between two species of human, one of which will supplant the other, and hence on the primal scene and originary mirror stage, from which all humanity subsequently matures, away from this imagined encounter between two forms of the human. It is a scene where gaze, counter-identification, ego-differentiation, counter-specularity, reconnaissance, and relation are experienced in performance of primordial foundational difference, where the framing to themselves and for the other of the sensing of ipseity and alterity, and arguably subjectivity itself, are never so radically, or, frustratingly for subsequent investigation, so irrecoverably staged. The second, consequent in time on the first, traces the first stirrings of the emergence of the idea of humanity, understood not only as evolved biological state, but as contact-orienting value within civilization and culture. But before we probe all this further, let us make sure we are aware of just some of the historical and scientific facts, that we have them to the extent that we can write. So we know that there is no single lineage in humanity, that there were different species of humanity at a certain time in prehistory. We know that Neanderthals had tools. We know that they didn't probably domesticate animals. We know that they were, the evidence suggests, cannibalistic. We have very little idea about the nature of their speech or language, although DNA evidence suggests that the existence of the FOXP2 gene, which is important in the handling of speech and language, well, we know they had that. We know they were fair-skinned and reddish or blonde-haired. We know that the first excavations of Neanderthal men happened in 1829 in Liège, in Belgium. Subsequent discoveries in the Neander Valley in near Düsseldorf, hence Neanderthal. And, of course, the thing that everyone wonders about is addressed by Clive Finlayson in his book Neanderthal, the Humans Who Went Extinct. I'm reading from, I'll read just a short paragraph from this book. One niggling issue remains that we need to deal with. One niggling issue remains that we need to deal with before moving on to the next episode of the story. Did the Neanderthals and the ancestors interbreed? Although this has been a long-standing question, it received heightened importance in 1999 when a team led by Portuguese archaeologists made the bold claim that they had found a skeleton that showed precisely that Neanderthals had mated with the ancestors. The skeleton was claimed to be anatomically intermediate between a Neanderthal and an ancestor, and the discovery inevitably opened up a new controversy. To date, there is no consensus on the nature of the skeleton. But what is for me unacceptable is the claim that the skeleton is an indication that Neanderthals and ancestors mated regularly and in many places. This is yet another example of extreme overgeneralization, but we should try to see the logic behind such an apparently rash claim. As you can see, we really know very little at all. And yet, you know, with the very little we know, what is interesting in all of this for the purposes of this paper is the cavalier attitude to the facts that we do have concerning prehistoric humanity in fiction. In cinema, for instance, to stick with this form just a while longer, there is scant interest in the precision. That's okay. There is scant interest in the precision of the record. Dinosaurs can regularly be depicted as the predatory contemporaries of humans, for instance, as if the instinct that pits humanity against outsize animality leads to too good a story to pass up. This would persist in the 20th century, of course, in King Kong scenarios, where a great ape, also as it happens, rather fond of blondes, be it Fay Wray in 1933 or Jessica Lange in 1976 or Naomi Watts in 2005, a great ape is discovered once the secrets of Skull Island are probed to have some remarkably human qualities. And indeed, this arguably parallels one of the tropes that orient what fascinates us about Neanderthal. For Neanderthal, who can be reconstructed only through speculation on skulls found on little islands of skeletal remains among seas overflowing with the timeless accretions of history, is almost a cipher for a concept, for the idea of the human in a state of almost pure potentiality, for the tabula rasa of humanity, the tabula rasa state of humanity. We foist onto Neanderthal the presumption of humanity. Neanderthal, for instance, emoted, must have, it seems, we are sure of that. Doubtless Neanderthal did. That is not the point at issue. It is rather that in the prospect of this emoting, there is the presupposition of the emergence in fictional representations of Neanderthal, not of emotion, but rather, how shall we put it, of finer feeling, of a sentience and a consciousness that is not merely a registering, apprehending receptor of pleasure and pain, and sensation, but an active sensitivity, a selective, deliberating, discriminating percipience that can ultimately pass the critical determining test, selflessness. In countless narratives, it is the test through which, if passed, the humanity quotient of the scarcely human appears to be guaranteed. In Neil Badmington's essay Pod Almighty, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, this capacity for selflessness is equated with desire, but also quite simply with a capacity for love, with the uniquely human scope for the overcoming of what Derrida calls the crisis of verses. With the fact that humans have feelings, aliens do not, that for the inhuman, quoting Badmington, love is the problem, that, quote, to be human is to desire, to possess emotions, to trouble the sacred distinction between the human and the inhuman, end quote. Recall, taking film once more as a point of reference, how the same idea works its way through other straightforward representation of the inhuman and the post-human, from King Kong to X-Men, from The Matrix and the Rise of the Machines to AI, from iRobot to Avatar, where humanity saves itself from its own ravagings through, precisely, humanity as we like to construct it in its most salvific and defining form. In other words, through a moment of reassertion and reaffirmation of selflessness and self-forgetting and love. In this respect, Jean-Jacques Annaud's The Quest for Fire is emblematic, the film The Quest for Fire. It's a 1992 film. The film purports to be the story of the discovery of fire in prehistoric times. We are where all of us always already, it seems, Promethean. And the butchery between and across various tribal groupings, or rather, very unsettlingly and with very stark visual detail, different species of the human, all of whose lives are very clearly nasty, brutish and short. In actual fact, there is no very real need for a quest for fire, however, as that has already been achieved in the very beginning of the film. The film in fact opens with a communal scene around a fire. For most of the different human species in the film do have access to it. They are just not very good at replenishing it and keeping it going. Once they do master that skill, the quest for fire becomes a different one and appears to be achieved in the final scene. The fire becomes metaphorical and quite unabashedly linked to love, what Badminton was equating with humanity itself. With the first stirrings in one representative of his tribe, or species, there is a studied ambiguity in the film about that, towards a lovemaking moved to tenderness and reciprocity, rather than characterized, as depicted earlier and frequently in the film, by rape and wantonness. It is enough to remind us of the immemorial oppositionality between humanity and Neanderthal, and the freedom with which the latter continues to be associated with invective, with an identification of coarse and uncouth behavior. In truth, of course, reciprocity, tenderness, and love do need language in their expressiveness. And this connects with the singular and overriding difficulty in the representation of Neanderthal. How, indeed, is one to bring to representation in language prehistoric consciousness or prehistoric language itself? Especially since, as Chris Gosden indicates, quote, Neanderthal societies, for whatever reason, restrained the need to develop sophisticated forms of linguistic communication. It is a view that extends his idea that, quote, all fully modern humans of whatever time and place have the same capacity for culture as ourselves, but may not have learned or needed to exercise that capacity. This implicit presupposition of culturelessness is not one I dare explore with an audience of social scientists, so let me instead point to just three examples here of representation of what linguistic communication there might have been, starting with Anthony Burgess, who in fact I shall only mention. He was the one charged with writing the screenplay for Quest for Fire. Imagine the assignment, writing prehistoric dialogue for a screenplay with a curtis sensitiveness and with something that goes beyond indulgence of mere guttural animal sound, beyond transcription of vocalization, which, if not objectless, is a little less than reference rich. Let us move to the second example, Jack London, more famous for Call of the Wild and White Fang. You have a copy of the last two pages of Jack London's novel Before Adam. So have a look at Before Adam, which Jack London published in Everybody's magazine between 1906 and 1907, a story based, as the first page tells us, in remarkably poised prose by the first-person prehistoric narrator on the, quote, pictures, pictures, pictures of the fear that reigns supreme in that period known as the Mid-Pleistocene. I find two things interesting here. Firstly, the immediate emphasis in language minded to invoke Neanderthal on pictures, as if this is what must immediately predominate in terms of availability of modes of representation in a linguistically unsophisticated time. And then secondly, and of course inauthentically, the self-conscious, self-evaluating writing by a prehistoric human outliving other human species of how, quote, we were inconsecutive, illogical, inconsequential, and of how, quote, the device of writing lay so far in the future that I am appalled when I think of it. The time, clearly, is not actually, the timescape of the novel is not justified by the oniric structure of the novel. And if you look at the last two pages, there is something quite unsettling in representation of prehistoric consciousness that follows this development. Page 118. I often wonder about this line of descent. I, the modern, am incontestably a man, yet I, Pictus, the primitive, am not a man. somewhere, and by a straight line of descent, these two parties to my dual personality were connected, were to folk before their destruction in the process of becoming men, and did I and mine carry through this process? On the other hand, may not some descendant of mine have gone into the fire people, fire again, and become one of them? I do not know. There is no way of learning. One thing only is certain, and that is that Bigtooth did stamp into the cerebral constitution of one of his progeny all the impressions of his life, and stamped them in so indelibly that the hosts of intervening generations have failed to obliterate them. And then after this, if you are so minded, you can look at all the other attempts of this most difficult task for the writer's craft, glancing at Orwell's novel series, perhaps remembering Conan Doyle's The Lost World, taking in the implications of H.G. Wells' belief in his story The Grizzly Folk, that, quote, the Neanderthaler had no speech, taking a tour through the genealogy of the Saporia for representation, as it is traced in Charles de Paolo's book, Human Prehistory in Fiction, before coming to the third and perhaps supreme example, William Golding's The Inheritors. Golding's novel tries to live in the space, on the spaces of the tortured attempt at the articulation of both thought and language when both are rudimentary. It is for that reason a deeply affecting work, not least in the various episodes where thought announces itself through language for self and other in the sharing of a mental image, as when the character of Locke tells Li Ku, quote, I have a picture of the water and the cave. It is as good an example as any of the insurmountable inauthenticity of fictional language in the representation of Neanderthal, for the example just read is already too evolved in terms of language acquisition and grammatical structure for the nature of the thought expressed, which essentially turns on the wonder at having thought at all, and thence on the effort of its communicability, when, as they remain aware, the more usual experience for the Neanderthals in this respect is that of being, quote, called back to their individual skulls. I have a picture of what is to be done, says Mal, one of the leaders of the tribe, and we then read that, quote, when the word had been said, it was already as though the action was already alive in performance, and they worried, unquote. Not least when, quote, quite without warning, all the people shared a picture inside their heads. The Inheritors is therefore a story of the birth of language and thought and representation, of the awareness of the self-same and the other, so that it is all the more poignant that the eruption of the absolutely other comes through in the encounter with, quote, the scent of another, the scent of others, the new people, as they come to be termed. Mal, the leader, is the one who names the moment. It is repeated by woman, by Fa, the character Fa, quote, someone is other. The other has technology, articulated by Locke as, quote, hollow logs, boats, in other words, so that the other comes over the water for this moment of an inaugural encounter where prehistory shifts. There is the description of that encounter in pages 137, 138, and 139, which are in your copies. I won't read it, except, it's too long, of course, except to point you to the bottom of page 137. At last they saw the new people face to face and in sunlight. They were incomprehensibly strange. Their hair was black and grew in the most unexpected ways. The bone face in the front of the log had a pine tree of hair that stood straight up, so that his head, already too long, was drawn out as though something were pulling it upward without mercy. And so on. This, then, is the gaze. And in an astonishingly intuitive turn to Golding's art, self and subjectivity themselves are born immediately in Locke, previously described as the one in the tribe with, quote, the least pictures. First we read, portentously, that, quote, already the familiar had altered. And then the space of desire, as a post-structuralist would call it, is immediately born, just when the other has already been glimpsed. Here is the key passage perhaps in the entire novel, quote, "Fear was coming from far. It was not a short picture, but a general sense, a bitter smell, a dead silence and agonized attention, a motionlessness and a tensed awareness that began to call forth the same in him. Now more than ever before, there were two locks, outside and inside." Unquote. And with this division comes the effect of the encounter with the other, without and within the self-same. We read, quote, "The inner lock could look forever, but the outer that breathed and heard and smelt and was awake always was tightening on him like another skin. He was more frightened than ever before in his life." Unquote. That is, of course, because the dimly glimpsed process of extinction has already begun. As Fatal's lock, we are shut in. This is, of course, a deeply dramatic scene. It positions us at the center of the irrecoverable events of the greatest whodunit ever, as Chris Gosden calls it in his Guide to Prehistory. Quote, "Did we wipe out the Neanderthals directly, outcompete them more indirectly, or did they die out due to an inability to cope with the changing conditions?" And in a further dramatization of events, he reminds us that prehistory keeps ending, even for modern man. He gives us the example of how prehistory ended for Ongka, O-N-G-K-A, the name of a member of the Kawelka group in Papua New Guinea, at 10 a.m. on 8th March 1933, when an expedition first flew over the New Guinea highlands in a chartered junkers biplane looking for promising areas for gold prospecting. Gosden reminds us that there was once a day in history when the Kawelka had never seen or even imagined Western humanity, and then there was the next day, where the encounter had happened, and by the end of which they were already in the process of history, just as there was once a day where the Native Americans had never seen a white man before, and then a day after that when they had, and just as there was once a day when Neanderthal had never seen Homo sapiens before, and the next day where the encounter with the other, with us, ancestrally, had taken place, after which all humanity changed. December 1910 is truly put in its place here. There is melodrama in this drama, of course, and one can play it for all it's worth. So let me just play its strings a little more plangently. Bear with me. In doing so, I need to remind you of Last Man narratives. I have been fascinated by Last Man scenarios ever since, as a child, I watched Charlton Heston in the stirring, troubling opening of The Omega Men, based on Richard Matheson's novel, driving a red Ford LTD convertible through the ravaged streets of an eerily depopulated city. That's cool, I thought, before realizing that there was something very sinister in the whole idea of being the last man on Earth. Certainly, Heston seems to have had a great deal of bad luck with this experience, repeating it in Planet of the Apes. Now, beyond Hollywood, what is interesting in all this is that critics like Morton Paley, who has done a good deal of genealogical work on Last Man narratives, such critics have established that beyond Revelations, the first Last Man narrative was Le Dernier Homme, completed in 1795 by a French priest called Jean-Baptiste François Xavier Cousin de Grainville, and published with ironic appropriateness posthumously in 1805. There is, you will agree, something strange in this lateness. Why is it that this kind of apocalyptic narrative emerged so comparatively late? There is something quite strange that the cultural imaginary did not appear to have this idea before 1795. Whatever the reasons, and they could be intriguing, Grainville's vision was followed up, of course, in Byron's poem Darkness, written following the eruption of Tambora in 1816, ash clouds again, in the Dutch East Indies, which speaks of the pall of a past world, and of this extraordinary vision of an altogether different kind of gaze to the one we witnessed in Golding. I'm going to read just a short series of lines from Darkness. Byron's Darkness. "The crowd was famished by degrees, but two of an enormous city did survive, and they were enemies. they met beside the dying members, the dying embers of an altar place where had been heaped a mass of holy things for an unholy usage. They raked up and shivering scraped with their cold skeleton hands the feeble ashes, and their feeble breath blew for a little life and made a flame which was a mockery. Then they lifted up their eyes as it grew lighter and beheld each other's aspects, saw and shrieked and died. Even of their mutual hideousness they died, unknowing who he was upon whose brow famine had written fiend. The world was void, the populous and the powerful was a lump, seasonless, herbless, treeless, manless, lifeless. Indeed, Byron's poem leaves us with a manless world, the possibility of which is glimpsed also in Mary Shelley's The Last Man and many other survivalist novels since, right up to Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Before we explore the relevance of all this to the question of Neanderthal, let me make a point about manlessness in the world. It is predicated on the last paragraph of The Road, which begins to tell the story, just where the novel ends, of the world without humanity, or imagines the story, a world without humanity. This story has been told elsewhere recently, of course, in Ellen Wiseman's The World Without Us. Charmingly, Ellen Wiseman imagines what the world would be like if there would, if we were to die out, but everything else were to survive. And he imagines things in over a month, over a year, 5 years, 20 years, 50 years. Or documentary series like Life Without People, based on the same idea. But there is something altogether more unsettling in McCarthy's novel, which concludes a process identified 15 pages before the end. There McCarthy refers to, quote, the ponderous counter-spectacle of things ceasing to be, the sweeping waste, hydroptic and coldly secular, the silence. Here, then, is an extract from the last paragraph. On their backs were vermiculate patterns that were maps of the world in its becoming, maps and mazes, of a thing which could not be put back, not be made right again. In the deep glens where they lived, all things were older than man, and they hummed of mystery. McCarthy gives us this vision of the impossible story, how to recount a world empty of humanity, where no consciousness or perception or language can represent eventless time. It reminds me of an experiment I conducted in a creative writing class yesterday, where we were speaking about storylessness in fiction, so that the students and I then spoke about the challenge of writing a story about an empty room. Beckett has come as close to that as anyone, as we know, but so has Blanchot in Awaiting Oblivion, from which one of my epigraphs was taken. As John Gregg tells us, this is a novel almost completely stripped of any references to concrete reality in favor of a minimalist universe. A hotel room sparsely furnished with a bed, an armchair and a table is where everything takes place. The story has also been reduced to the bare essentials. The basic storyline concerns the relationship between a man and a woman who spend an incalculable amount of time waiting for something to happen to them that never does, and vainly trying to remember something that may already have happened to them. That's John Gregg. The outcome of this wait for oblivion, when it comes, is stark. It is referred to darkly, quote, as the affront of presence, just as one character tells the other, quote, how little you speak, you who are the last to make a sign. After that sign, the last sign in this human exchange, what is left, and the last words on this book on oblivion's wait, for oblivion waits for us just as we do for it, is, quote, the reserve of things in their latent state. The reserve of things in their latent state, it is something we shall never see by definition when we are not there. The problem is, however, is that we are always there. It is this point that brings me to my conclusion. I have read many Last Man narratives, more than is probably healthy. And apart from concluding that Graham V's, just like Kellogg's Cornflakes, is the original and best, there is one thing that I have consistently found remarkable. The Last Man is never alone. It is as if the writers of Last Man narratives just cannot give figure to absolute non-relationality. Another human somehow is always discovered, always reveals themselves. There is always more humanity. Is not this the experience of Neanderthal too? Well, not quite. The difference is that the discovery of the other human, of more humanity in Last Man narratives, comes as a relief. One has discovered interaction and exchange again. But in the story of Neanderthal, what has happened to him is us. We who, as the introduction pointed out, are always already post-apocalyptic and post-human in our experience and living out of the human. We come to seal the fact and finality of extinction. A reference then, at the end, to one Last Man narrative which multiplies them. The Last Human, it's this book by G.J. Sawyer and Victor Diek. In The Last Human, the story is told of the death of 22 species of human, from Sahelanthropus chadensis through to Paranthropus boisei, and finally to human Neanderthalensis. Neanderthal, the dead human animal forever without representation and technology, whom humanity never could mourn. Neanderthal, a reminder that we have died many times, we humans, over and again across species and time. We are still telling the tale of those deaths, of which Neanderthals is only the best known example. And as we do so, what it is that we are playing out is our own autothanatography. Thank you.
Thank you, Ivan, for a most unusual talk, which references many different possible literatures, films, and ideas, of which I'm sure the audience are aware of different segments of the literature or films which Ivan mentioned. I'll just begin with a minor question, perhaps, and then go on to ask a slightly more direct question of your paper. The minor question is that doesn't the archaeological evidence show also that Neanderthal did bury their dead and make fire?
Yes.
Because that increases the poignancy and the nearness of them.
It absolutely does, yes. And of course what is unsettling about that is the glimpse we have of the tenderness of the burial at the same time that we know that they were cannibalistic.
But of course you have that with humans as well. I mean, you have many cannibal groups, and they have quite refined notions of self and quite refined notions of life and death. Mm. So, I mean, what comes across for me from this notion of the burial of the dead is, of course, some sort of way of thinking about afterlife.
Yes.
About this world and one other world, or some other worlds. It suggests, the very evidence of burial suggests a rather highly refined consciousness, with or without verbal language.
Yeah. You know. I mean, what I didn't speak about in the paper is we know nothing, of course, about their belief systems. This is a people without possibly religion, and yet we find it so irresistible to foist a belief system on them. The film Iceman ends with an almost religious scene of affirmation and assertion, as the Iceman, who is a frozen being brought to life, at the end of that film, he's apparently saluting a higher being just as he is about to die. It's quite unsettling, because like everything else, we foist religion onto these beings in the same way we foist language, emotion. We want to anthropomorphize them.
Well, obviously unknowability is a question which arises all the time, even with Neolithic archaeology. I mean, this is this whole question of not being certain, not knowing, the evidence being insufficient, the speculative nature. But just one other question before I hand over. It does seem that your paper moves with a kind of trajectory towards the possibility that what these different representations of Neanderthal are concerned with is living without optimism, is confronting. It's a very interesting thought experiment on how imagining other worlds and other species, using language in its verbal form, because I leave open the possibility that they're non-linguistic forms of communication, and the emotion of genuine total hopelessness, the genuine absence of optimism, is a quasi-religious experience. That what's going on here, in fact, is that your various authors, including Golding in that beautiful, sensitive book, are playing with what would it be like for us if we could generally say, that's it, the story is over. Now there is nothing more to be told. The living with, we all, it's a dwelling on life without the optimistic drive in it.
Yes, I would agree. What is interesting, I think, is that almost every attempt to fictionalize that experience makes an effort to bring in some moment of affirmation within and across that hopelessness. It's definitely there in Golding, it's very evidently there in Anu, where that last scene I referred to is almost like a promise of emerging humanity. So yes, I would agree with that. There is a sense that one is trying to define humanity as the attempt to emerge from hopelessness, from unbroken pessimism, from just subsistence.
Neanderthals have always fascinated me, and I found your paper very interesting and enjoyable. There are three things I'd like to say. First of all, I don't think we can be too smug about our survival, because in fact Neanderthals were around for about 200,000 years, and we've only been around about one-fourth, one-fifth of that, so we've got a long way to go before we say we were as successful as the Neanderthals were. Second point is that DNA, again, there's been that long debate about inbreeding. Did we mate with Neanderthals? For a long time, I remember up to just 3 years ago, seeing a Discovery Channel program where it was hinted that we have Neanderthal blood. Now, in January 2009, that discussion seems to be over, because from DNA testing, it seems to be confirmed that we're two different species. We could apparently mate, but our children would be infertile, similar to a tiger or a lion, for example. They could have cubs, but their children would be infertile. That happens often in nature. Now, with regards to how we interpret history, I lecture in historiography, and I'm very much aware of the postmodernist idea of how the person who is writing, when he's writing, and all that is going to give you a very different interpretation. I always tell my students to watch out for the Whig interpretation of history, which gives the idea of progression. Because once you have, but this is the big but, once you have Cro-Magnon, which is modern human beings, that is us, DIQ more or less is stable. So if you get somebody from 7,000 years ago, it's not possible, I mean, but if you bring up a child, a Cro-Magnon child today, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. But with Neanderthal, we've stepped into another species, and there we don't know where IQ is concerned. So I think it's a bit unfair to say that the way we've portrayed them is just a question of not being able to empathize. It's very, very difficult. We're talking about a different species here. They were humanoid, but we did not evolve one from each other. We had a common ancestor, no doubt. But how do you empathize with another species? It's not that straightforward. And with regards to the burials, it's been contested as well, because apparently there are some beetles which carry seeds towards dead bodies, and some archaeologists have given that explanation to the flower buds around I don't know, I mean, how correct this is, but it's been heavily contested that they did bury their dead and put flowers and all that. Thank you.
Despite the truth of what you said, very, very accurate, if I may use Professor Klaus' words, is the story over, especially if we meet it, eh?
Yes, it's over,
because it's not a dead end. What do we know? You yourself stress how much we do not know.
From the DNA, we were two different species. Today, you can have a horse and a donkey mating.
What about racial memory, especially if there was mating? And I would say there was, if I had to do a bet on that.
They could have children, but their children are infertile, so they can't carry on from there. You come to a dead end evolution-wise.
It depends. I'm not talking about evolution.
I think Jack London has a very, very, very staggering intuition. Let me read the last paragraph, where what we have now, this is in a sense only the folly, but also only the wisdom of fiction. So Red Eye is a perhaps Neanderthal-like being who is dominating the pages earlier in the novel, but then who dies out. So there is one other thing of which I'll be reading from two paragraphs, but skipping just a few sentences so that it's not over long. There is one other thing of which I must speak before I close. It is a dream that I dream often, and in point of time, the real event must have occurred during the period of my living in the high, inaccessible cave. I came upon a tribe of people. I crouched in a thicket and watched them at play. Suddenly they hushed their noise and ceased their capering. They shrank down in fear and quested anxiously about with their eyes for a way of retreat. Then Red Eye walked in among them. They cowered away from him. All were frightened, but he made no attempts to hurt them. He was one of them. At his heels, on stringy bended legs, supporting himself with knuckles to the ground on either side, walked an old female of the people, his latest wife. He sat down in the midst of the circle. I can see him now as I write this, scowling, his eyes inflamed as he peers about him at the circle. And as he peers, he crooks one monstrous leg and with his gnarly toes scratches himself on the stomach. And then I think comes the key point in terms of this discussion. He is Red Eye. And the last words are, he is Red Eye, the atavism. And in a sense, I think a lot of this hinges to comment on both your views. First of all, of course, the unsettling fact of the very simultaneity of species coexisting. I think we still find that unsettling.
Why
the
would
idea
you say
that there was
the great Golding focuses on scent. Hinge that, latch it on to what? Suskind's perfume, eh? And that incredible creation.
And animal attraction.
That is Neanderthal heritage, eh? And Professor Kalluz, talking of apocalyptic texts and 1798, you set me thinking, what about Dance Nocturnal upon St. Eustace's Day? It has always given me the feeling that he is the last man. The key word is hydroptic.
We spoke about Dante earlier this week, didn't we? And the strange...
I agree with most of what she was saying. She was being very, especially from the scientific point of view, archaeological, but very, very, very accurate. But of course, I come from different realms.
which does not necessarily mean that we can't communicate. Of course, that's why, that's the beauty of this small group here. Mm-hmm. Most probably we come from
different
spheres of human activity, as it should be.
Yes.
That she was very, from my comparatively speaking, very limited knowledge to hers, which is very, 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 very accurate.
But the question that we're dealing with here is not just the question of what happened. We're also dealing with the ways in which human beings, we're dealing with the ways in which human beings play with the representations of what happened.
Yes, that's
the concern.
To Golding and Susskind,
that's the concern.
And the possibility of representability at all.
Pardon?
The possibility of representability at all,
yes.
Of
and
course.
And the connection is with Golding and the inheritors and the Zen, they send. They smelled them differently. It wafted on to them, the extinction that was inevitably to come. By the sense of smell.
So many different things are going on in the account which you presented of Neanderthal literature and Neanderthal film. What I, of course, find most riveting from a very personal perspective is what it is like to think about, philosophize about a world without optimism. Right. It almost redefines our sense of selfhood if there is no future. Tied up with notions of human agency, human will, whatever you happen to believe, whatever you happen to prefer, there is the notion of some sort of forward planning, some forward possibility. And what strikes me most, of course, is that we're playing with a creature who ran out of possibility. But we're playing at that with a purpose, an almost morally instructive purpose in this kind of Neanderthal literature, is to make us, as it were, imaginatively think about ourselves. It's a kind of metaphor for human beings thinking about what it would be like to live without purpose. And that brings up questions about the Holocaust. It brings up questions about concentration camp life. It brings up, you are putting yourself not in the place of the Jewish victim, you're putting yourself in the place of, in some ways, an even sadder victim of a different species, who obviously probably had no chance whatsoever. Mm. These are the kinds of dividing lines and points of entry which to me strike look very, very useful for moral theory and for theories of human personhood.
I did toy
it's
with
not a dead end.
No, not a dead end at all. No, I did toy with the idea of using the writing of the disaster as an analogy, but then thought perhaps not. It would have put the focus on a different kind of... the writing of the disaster is a book by Blanchot, of course. It would have put the emphasis on a totally different kind of experience there.
I was going to ask about having an experience. This is a phrase that came up a few times.
Yes.
Because you ascribed the post-human experience to the Neanderthal. It was an experience that they had.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's our experience. And the way I understand that is, I mean, one of the ideas that was implicit, I think, is the Wittgensteinian idea that you don't experience your own death. Your death is not an event in your life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not and cannot be the Neanderthal's experience of post-humanism. There's always going to be an other there.
Yes. Already.
And so what sense is it our experience? And why should we posit the Neanderthal as our other, that which we survive? Mm. It seems to take a speciesist position that seems undermotivated. You know, why that? Why not in relation to genocide? You mentioned North American, or even primates and extinctions in the natural world that are occurring today. Why do we posit, or why are you suggesting that in our cultural imaginary the Neanderthal features as our other? Why that speciesist position?
First of all, just to get to the a minor point about the historical record, there have been some not very credible speculations about genocide. Now, but of course, if you believe that, if you're going down that road, then a little bit of oppositionality does occur.
In relation to Neanderthals
having been, if you go with that kind of interpretation.
Sorry, just because I wasn't clear enough. I wasn't talking about that genocide. What I meant was, why take a biological perspective, not a more cultural, even familial perspective? So the loss of a particular culture through genocide. Mm. Why not position that as our relative other, or the loss of a parent? Mm. Why should that not be the primal scene?
The loss of
a parent or an ancestor, as opposed to a species.
Right. Well, I think it's, first of all, I think the very dynamic of cultural amnesia in all this is interesting. And I think the regularity in fiction, not perhaps so much within paleoanthropology, the regularity in fiction with which there is always a moment of the gaze, always a moment of encounter, always a moment, therefore implicitly, either of contestation or of reciprocity. I think that's always interesting. And I think that the fact that the art of someone like Golding is trying to actually articulate experience itself, when the apprehension of experience is clearly not articulable to these beings at all, to themselves. You know, that passage I read about the same and the two emerging selves of Locke is, I think, important there. I think in that moment there is an inherent speciesist encounter, or the potential for it. So it may be more a dynamic within the fictional representation of Neanderthal rather than something we would want to theorize away from this. Definitely if we are using, for instance, the riddles, the animal that therefore I am. I mean, then of course the discourse has to shift. What may be, I think, interesting in what you're pointing to is perhaps a little bit of an adolescent impulse in the fiction. Let's bring these two together and see what happens. And of course there's going to be a clash. And that's the way it makes a better story. So it may, and I'd need to think a little bit about whether this is
qualitatively different.
I'd need to think a little bit about that, because it seems that fiction can't resist staging that kind of encounter. And what I think that satisfies you about that is precisely that it can be a little bit facile. Am I...
Yes, why that encounter? Why not the extinction of a primate species today? Or genocide?
Oh, I see, yeah. You
know, why does that... I mean, you've addressed it, though, but that was the...
No, but I see that it... Yeah, I mean, if what you've just said puts, of course, another twist on this. I think... I'm trying hard to avoid the phrase ancestral guilt, but it may have something to do with it. It may have something to do with it. Yes. The realization that we're not done with them yet. Yes, yes.
Yes, I'm interested in Neanderthal as a template for constructions of non-Western or pre-Western, or in some cases anti-Western cultures. To some extent, I think what I'm going to suggest links with what the gentleman in front of me began. It might be shifting, in which case, you know, bear. You evidently have attempts in just about any imperial culture to depict the other, meaning the beyond the bounds of empire, as being somehow less than or pre or possibly monstrous. And although Neanderthal discourse begins, and I don't think it's a coincidence, with basically bourgeois modernity. That was only 10 years after the French Revolution. And the mid-19th century was a very troubled time for that sort of development. But you do have things like that before. So you have your Goliath, you have your Polyphemus, and you have the Barbaroi that can only point and say, as in presumably our case, look, Viper. So I think it's worth having your comments on that. Okay, so Neanderthal as model of non-Western otherness, and possibly as a way of making your other less worthy of moral respect. So yes, why not? Easier to kill off. And finally, of course, you're interested in fiction, but one important, extremely influential last man narrative, but not a fiction narrative, I would say a pseudo-scientific rhetoric narrative, is, of course, Fukuyama's 1992 End of History, and in the second edition, with the addition of And the Last Man. Can we have your thoughts on that?
Yes, I'm in terms of the imperialist construction or crypto-imperialist construction of Neanderthal or proto. What I find that is very striking, I mean, I have to cite, the issue of tone here, because what I find very striking in constructions of Neanderthal, and they are, I think, constructions, even when we are trying to make them as scientific as we can. The record is clearly quite speculative, even when it is being scientific. But what I have always found very striking and perhaps even moving, and therefore, one can definitely not cast emotion away from this scene, is the attempt among scientists and definitely among fiction writers to bring in empathy, the point you mentioned. There is clearly a sense of awe that one encounters when reading. I'm hoping to find a passage which will, I think, if I can find it, which will, I think, exemplify this. One of the things that fascinates me in this is the scene of a scientist holding up a skull, a Neanderthal skull or a other kind of skull, and it just replaced the Yorick, Hamlet and the Yorick scene, doesn't it? It's quite striking there. You could play all this back into that excavating scene, and it all plays so finely, of course. And let me read out this passage. For a fossil, this is by Donald C. Johansson, paleoanthropologist. For a fossil hunter like myself, there are few experiences that make the heart beat faster than the discovery of one of our ancestors' skulls. I recall with great clarity when my colleague Joel Rack announced his discovery of a 3-million-year-old male skull of Australopithecus afarensis during our 1992 Haidar research project in the Afar region of Ethiopia, staring into the fossilized bony outline of a face long dead and long forgotten. It's, you know, in a sense, Hamlet and Yorick again. Is a rare privilege, one that rewards like few others. Anyway, it goes on like that. Clearly there is a relation of tenderness to what is being excavated. Whether the feeling then ever becomes imperialist, you know, I'm trying to bring my memory even of Said's Orientalism here, as it were, and I don't think I can honestly say that I've detected that kind of impulse in the writings I encountered, anyway, both within the paleoanthropological record and the fiction. In the fiction, it is almost as if the attempt to recreate them, to reconstruct them, is. And this perhaps is interesting in terms of your imperialist question. It is almost an act of reparation, because
that's an interesting take.
It's almost an act of reparation because here we are. We have the world. They don't. One can at least reimagine them sensitively. So in that case, then it is. If there is ever a situation of colonizer's guilt, I think it's there. And your second question was about. I can't recall the second question.
Well, there wasn't a question. There was a reference to Last Man narratives, not in fiction, but in.
Yes.
In sociological rhetoric.
Yes.
Because that really puts the hat in the right place.
Yes. Well, interestingly, Fukuyama's idea of the end of history and the notion that all dialectic has, as it were, stopped. He himself kind of withdrew that position. History forced him to, in a sense.
We weren't blaming him for not having changed.
No.
Had an interesting discussion last time here.
The interesting thing is that Fukuyama has now, of course, gone into, you know, like Eugene Thacker and others, very, very, very assiduously following the whole question of bioengineering and the biotechnological revolution. He's taken that line there. What is interesting then, I think, in that discourse, in his work, and definitely in the work of someone like Thacker, is that it is all forward-looking. It never casts a glance backward at how these techniques might help us to understand ourselves better. But that's just, you know, a small intertext in a very, very vast field.
My question is about your thoughts about the articulating of an experience of something which is prelingual and therefore in a way other to humanity. And my question was comes from the interest that I have in ecology and whether your thought can be extended to the possibility, therefore, of articulating an experience of that which is not human in terms of eco-criticism and the possibility of perceiving a world which is not colonized, to use some of the words which were used before, by a human perspective of the world and of existence. So whether what you are talking about could be extended for that. I know that I'm sort of asking a question which is outside of the paper itself, but whether there could be the possibility of seeing this encounter with Neanderthal men and rethink it in terms of an encounter with the world as other?
With a world as other, but still, as it were, just to be simplistic a little here, our world, right, perceived otherwise. This is what you're interested in.
Free ourselves, if I might add to Mario's point, that we can free ourselves from perspectives which belong to the 21st century program.
Which?
Clearly belong to a 21st century perspective being imposed on a world which
In a way, I mean, Conrad's part of the question is in a way interestingly explored by thousands of French lieutenants' women, just to bring fiction in again. Because there's a very worried and worrisome trend there, isn't there, in that novel which explores this, to some extent, that issue. The extra-human nature of language is something that I think all these writers have struggled with. I mean, Charles de Paulo's book, Human Prehistory in Fiction, in a sense addresses the issue and tends to almost marvel at the idea about how precisely we keep anthropomorphizing prehistoric consciousness and prehistoric views and perceptions and so on, thereby more or less suggesting that we can't escape the frame of human language. And I think this is why there is a sense of misrecognition always in texts, fictional texts, definitely with Jack London. I think there is always a sense of misrecognition in the style and the tones and the very grammar and so on that we're meeting there, that we're encountering there. It is because, you know, you're in a sense, definitely with Golding, honoring the attempt, the really, really tough attempt at representing that kind of extra-human consciousness. And you can see that however fine the book is, however impressive, you know, it can't be said that he succeeded, right? And therefore, I think for artists, for filmmakers, for fiction writers, and so on, this is an example of an almost insuperable technical challenge. And, you know, when McCarthy's book, for instance, stops just where the apprehending of eventless, unpeopled time could start to happen. It ends there. So, you know, how does one narrate? You know, if one thinks about the question about the issue of how one narrates eventless, unpeopled time, which is of course very hard, then I think it's a different way of asking the question you've just asked. These are just thoughts and reflections on what you've asked, Mario, not an answer, of course.
As you're thinking, I don't know whether sort of this makes sense or not, but do you see a relation between what you're saying and the impossibility of thinking death as opposed to dying? Therefore, it's something which...
Yes, definitely. I mean, something I didn't explore here, only kind of hinted at it in the last sentence of my paper, is the whole issue of autothanatography, which I explore as well. Yes, definitely. But whereas most autothanatographic texts, and of course they exist, are very personal and very individualized and very intimate, what you have here is the attempt, I mean, we had Lucia Baldrini last week speaking about heterobiography. It's a hetero-autothanatography, but you know, this is very close to moving towards Derrida's famous formulation on autobio-heterothanatography.
Which is,
what could it be? It is possibly, if it could be written, it is very probably going to articulate what Mario has just kind of glimpsed. What would it be? Autobio-heterothanatography. Okay. Literally speaking, it would be the writing as autobiography of the experience of my own death as utter.
You gave another paper on that, didn't you?
Yes.
About 3 years ago, you gave a paper in Gateway. On the whole issue.
Yeah, yeah.
You were quoting a particular author.
Mahado de Assis.
What do you consider the fascination with the Neanderthal and with the construction of a Neanderthal as an expression of anxiety arising from the fact that we can, as opposed to our ancestors, we can never be simultaneous, we can never coexist with another species who is the other human. We never can have that. And there's a big missing space which can be occupied by another species which does not exist. And just like the Romans destroyed the city and plowed, tried to bring in nature again, but it was never nature, it was orchards. It was their image of nature or whatever. Isn't this kind of other species we are reconstructing when we're trying to construct the Neanderthal?
Yes, I find that question fascinating, and I like the way you expressed it, you know, we can never be simultaneous. I think that is where Orthodox post-humanism comes in then. First of all, the whole question of anxiety at a very simple, basic, instinctual, visceral level. There is the anxiety, of course, as Dr. Catania pointed out, of having this happen to us somehow, you know, the experience of apocalypse being this time, apocalypse being this time experienced not in terms of survival but in terms of victimhood. But beyond that, what Orthodox post-humanist narratives are very good at depicting, of course, is indeed the simultaneity of human species alongside evolved humanity. And this is something that, of course, Catherine Hales explores in How We Became Post-Human, when she speaks about the fact that humanity is only one intermediate stage in the process of evolution, and we may eventually have a time when, if you like, and then of course all the usual scenarios kick in, where current humanity, as it were, coexists with android beings and so on. And that's what you get explored in very, very populist, perhaps Hollywood terms, but nonetheless, I think, fairly rewardingly, in films like X-Men or other kinds of narratives like that. There is a famous scene in Blade Runner, isn't there, where in the bar, where they're having a drink, and there are people there, but then there are also representatives of evolved species of human, all very convivially present, imbibing a drink. And I think that is not... I think in this sense, that is what someone like, what very many post-humanists have tried to explore, the simultaneity of an evolved humanity with the humanity we know, which is then, of course, why science fiction sometimes gets referred to as the new realism. Very intriguing comment.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Neanderthal. This talk was delivered by Professor Ivan Kalous.